Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, we'll explain the meaning behind Brat Summer and the debate over whether or not Pluto is really a planet. But first, it is time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
I'm glad that we can celebrate the successes and the legacy of Joe Biden and his 50 years of public service and do it outside of the context of a contentious presidential campaign.
We're Biden delegates until in such time that he decides not to run, which is what he did. And so that then effectively releases us to become delegates for somebody else. And of course, the most natural choice, because it was a team, we it's a Biden-Harris team. We, of course, are moving our vote and supporting Kamala Harris.
If he's put on that ticket, Arizona is going to go for Vice President Harris, the candidate of the Democratic Party. Arizona will likely go in that direction. So it picks up a key battleground state.
It is unfathomable that a 20-year-old on the radar of Secret Service and local law enforcement before President Trump went on stage was able to climb onto the roof of a building with a rifle and fire off multiple rounds before he was neutralized.
Do you recall any medical textbooks that use the phrase unborn human being?
I do not.
In your educational background, do you recall reading any medical literature that used the phrase unborn human being?
I don't.
And joining me to talk about a new Democratic presidential ticket, an Arizonan being considered to join that ticket, and more, our former state lawmaker, Paul Boyer. Paul, good morning.
Hey, Mark.
And attorney Tom Ryan. Tom, good morning to you.
Hey, good morning, Mark.
And Paul, we should mention you're making your debut on the Friday newscap, so welcome. Thank you for being here.
Glad to be here.
So, Tom, let me start with you on the change in ticket. President Biden, of course, on Sunday announced that he was withdrawing from the race. It seems as though the Democratic Party has really coalesced around Vice President Kamala Harris to be the party's nominee. In Arizona, does this change the race at all?
I think it does. I think there had been appropriately expressed certain concern over the age of Joe Biden. His debate performance was less than stellar. In fact, it was a bit scary and quite disappointing, unfortunately. Joe has been a good man and a great president, but I think it's impressive that he recognized it was time for him to step aside. I think you're going to see Arizonans, especially Democrats and independents and even some moderate Republicans, embrace the Harris and whoever she picks as her vice presidential candidate ticket this November.
Paul, what do you think? I mean, does this change the nature of the race? We've seen, for example, pretty much every poll that's come out has shown former President Trump leading President Biden in Arizona. Does having Vice President Harris at the top of the ticket change that, do you think?
Well, I think once people get to know who Kamala Harris really is, and in spite of what the media is now saying, she really was the lead on Biden's point person on the border and how much of a disaster that's been in Arizona in particular. I think that she's going to struggle in Arizona in particular. I still think that Trump pulls it out.
Do you think that it affects other states? I mean, we're an Arizona-based show, but does having somebody other than Joe Biden at the top of the Democratic ticket maybe help in other states?
Oh, I think it certainly does. But again, I mean, I think she's wrong on energy. I think she's wrong on life. I think she's wrong on what's going on in the Middle East right now. And so I think that once she's defined as a candidate, because you remember, she was only polling at, 1% in a Democratic primary when she last ran in 2020, and she got out before she even appeared on any ballots. And so I think she's a weak candidate generally. She's there because Joe Biden couldn't – physically, he couldn't continue – and that's the only reason why she's gotten to where she's gotten.
Tom, I want to ask you about something Paul mentioned in terms of the border and immigration, because that obviously is a big issue, especially among Republicans in this election. And she was sort of the point person on trying to get to the root causes of why, you know, why the situation was what it was. In a place like Arizona, does that become a drag for her?
I think it could, but let me explain two things. Number one, the Biden administration worked with leaders in the Senate, or Republican leaders in the Senate, to develop a bipartisan funding agreement to provide increased border security. And Donald Trump said, don't do it because I need this for my my campaign here in 2024. And he deep sixed it. And so they did. That's not Biden's fault or Harris's fault. That's Donald J. Trump's fault. Secondly, you know, you have to remember arrests are up for illegal immigration. We just arrested last night two of the biggest cartel drug dealers. This was effectively the Osama bin Laden arrest of the drug trade for here in America, the two they got in New Mexico last night. And I want to address the energy issue. I'm not sure what it is that is wrong on the energy issue. We are producing more oil and more gas than anything, any other country in at any other time in our nation's history. We are the leader of energy production right now. It may be that we don't like to talk about climate change and how you know, fossil fuels affect climate change. I get that. But we're producing more energy, more gas than anybody else in at any other time in our nation's history. So I think we're okay on that.
And Paul, do you foresee energy policy becoming an issue on the campaign trail? It doesn't seem like it's one that has come up much so far.
I think it should, because she's on record saying she's against fracking. She's against nuclear. She's against, of course, oil or gas, natural gas. She's against just the normal forms of energy. And we can't depend on wind and solar. We just can't. And so I think once the general public realizes that she's against all of those, it should be an issue, because it's not only a how much we pay at the pump, but it's really a national security issue.
So let me ask you this, Paul. We know that Vice President Harris has kind of a condensed timeline, right, to get her campaign up and running and to vet vice presidential candidates. One of those who she has reportedly requested documentation from is Arizona Senator Mark Kelly. Let's say, for example, that she picks him. Does that help her in Arizona, having someone like Mark Kelly, who has won two statewide races in the last 4 years, on the ticket?
I think it does help her here in Arizona in particular, just because, I mean, he's won two races. He's popular. He's got a great background. He's still a neophyte. I mean, he's got a great resume. But as far as politics are concerned and policy, he is new. But yeah, she would help herself by putting Mark Harris on, or yeah,
Kelly,
Mark Kelly on the ticket.
Does it
yeah.
do enough to overcome some of the problems, as you referenced, with her record on the border?
I don't know what Mark Kelly really brings to the table other than gun control. I don't know what else that he has done. I don't know if he's championed energy policy or anything of that nature. I know he's been big on water.
Oh, he brings his background as a naval pilot, an astronaut. So defense is huge, especially for here in Arizona. You know, he has guns. He's a member of the NRA, but he wants to bring sensible gun control back. We just, you know, this whole idea that a good man with a gun can stop a bad man with a gun is crazy. You know, just look at Uvalde. That was a little skinny guy. What were they afraid of, the little skinny guy, or were they afraid of the AR-15 like assault rifle that he had? That's what's doing it. And so, you know, yes, he has a sensible approach to gun control. I think it's going to help the Harris ticket if they nominate him.
All right. So obviously, all our crystal balls are fairly cloudy.
Yes.
Do you think Kelly is the pick?
No, I'm thinking it might be Minnesota Governor Waltz.
Really?
Yes.
Okay. Bit of a dark horse.
You know, Kelly would be a great choice, but I don't think that's going to happen. It would create problems here in Arizona. You lose a Democratic senator, you know, so you risk a seat when the U.S. Senate is so close. It creates more than one election cycle for us for that seat. You know, the only thing that you can say is it'll give Governor Hobbs a chance to appoint somebody to fill the seat that's a Democrat. Hopefully she'll fill somebody that would be electable.
Senator Ryan?
No.
I think if she's smart, she'll pick Josh Shapiro.
The governor of Pennsylvania.
That's right. But I don't know that she's going to take the smart approach. I think she's going to do something else. I really think that Mark Kelly is her choice.
What about Governor Whitmer from Michigan? That's another, you know, having a female, that's a little, I know that's scary for.
I think she said that she's not that interested though, right?
Yeah, she did say that.
Yeah.
But they asked for credentials.
Okay. I want to ask you also, Paul, the Republican vice presidential candidate, J.D. Vance, will be in Glendale, your neck of the woods, next week. We talked about, you know, Mark Kelly is fairly new in the Senate. Vance, Senator Vance, is also fairly new in the Senate. What does he bring to the Republican ticket, and what would you imagine him to bring to, you know, in terms of campaigning? Arizona is an important state for both campaigns.
Sure. I mean, well, I know he's wrote the book, The Hillbilly Elegy, and he apparently, you know, represents the middle class, the lower class worker. He's got a great degree, apparently. I don't really know a whole lot about him, to be honest with you. He wasn't my number one pick. I was really hoping for Marco Rubio or Ron DeSantis.
Do you think he, like him coming to Arizona, like, does that help the Trump-Vance ticket, do you think, having him here as opposed to, for example, former President Trump?
Sure. I think any attention that Arizona gets, and we always get a lot of attention, obviously we're a battleground state, any attention that a vice presidential candidate brings to Arizona is huge, whether that's Republican or Democrat. So, yeah, I think that as Arizonans, we should always welcome that. I don't know how much more, though. I don't know if the ceiling has already been is peaked.
Is it possible to have a non-political commercial on TV anymore? Like, I don't even know if there's any airtime left for the beer and the truck commercials. Tom, let me ask you quickly before we go to break. The state Republican Party has joined a lawsuit challenging the Harris campaign's use of Biden-Harris money. This was seen as a big reason, one of the reasons why Kamala Harris would be a good candidate, that she would have access to the tens of millions of dollars that the Biden-Harris ticket had already had. You're the lawyer in the room.
Yes, I hope. Yep, I think so.
Do you foresee this lawsuit being successful?
Not at all. There's a greater chance that it's going to snow this afternoon right in Phoenix, Arizona. No, it's not going to go anywhere. Look, transferring money from campaign to campaign, that ship has sailed. That train left the station. Pick whatever metaphor and mix them if you'd like. Grab the bull by the horns and let the chips fall where they may. That is not going to go anywhere. It's more performative litigation. It's not going to – they're not going to stop it.
Paul, do you see this lawsuit as a message in any way, or is this just sort of the Republican Party of various states trying to make sure that – trying to make it so that the Harris campaign has less money than they think they do?
I think it's really more delay. And I mean, look, Trump has been litigated. He's been in the courtroom for the last, 5 out of 6 months. And so I think it's turnaround is fair play from their perspective. And they're really just trying to delay that money getting into the Harris campaign.
Paul, let me start with you on news of a retracted endorsement this week from the Fraternal Order of Police. They retracted their endorsement of State Senator Justine Wadsack. This was after she got a speeding ticket, was able to use legislative immunity at the time to get out of it, allegedly made some comments about being politically persecuted for being then served with this ticket later on. And she is in a pretty competitive Republican Senate primary in the southern, in like Marana, North Tucson area.
Yeah. So good on the FOP for withdrawing their endorsement from her. Her actions were ridiculous, and it puts a stain on all honorable state senators and representatives who do their job, who don't throw out the, "Hey, don't you know who I am? I'm a state senator. You can't do this to me." It's so frustrating. I mean, I got pulled over one time by a DPS trooper, and he grabs my license and he comes back and he's like, "Hey, why didn't you tell me that you're a state rep when I was in the House at the time?" I'm like, "Because you pulled me over for speeding." I mean, it's
like, you didn't try to use the immunity thing, huh?
No.
So, I mean, do you think this impacts the race at all? She's going up against former state senator Vince Leach. She beat him 2 years ago. He, of course, was in the legislature. He served with you, right?
He did,
in the Senate.
Right.
So this is a pretty competitive race. And if Wadsack wins, this is a seat that Democrats think maybe they can flip to try to take control of the Senate. Does this incident affect that race at all, do you think?
For primary Republican voters, backing the blue really matters. And so I really think that this could have an impact in the Republican primary. I think Vince could pull it out.
What do you think, Tom?
Good question. First off, this whole idea of legislative immunity gets abused, and this was a classic example of it. And now she's dodging service. That's the thing that I think is bad. It's one thing to say, look, I'm a sitting senator and I'm just coming home. It's another thing to be dodging service afterwards, senator up and accept responsibility. That's a very, very hard right, rock-ribbed red district down there, and they love her. Even though there's been all this controversy before about where she lives, I think she returns.
Well, I wonder also if the timing of all of this happening with the popularity of early voting, I just wonder how many people in that district have already returned their ballots, maybe either for her or for Leach, and, you know, had voted before all this came out, if that makes a difference at all.
Yeah, you know what? Most elections, at least in Arizona, are won a week or two before the day of.
Okay.
Right. I agree with that.
Okay. So let's now talk about the abortion initiative that we saw. There was an effort by the Arizona Right to Life group is challenging challenging this initiative on a couple of grounds, one on signatures and one on the fact that they claim it is misleading the language that was used in the to collect signatures. Paul, the signatures things would seem to be a harder route to get it knocked off, just because you'd have to kick a lot of signatures off to get it out. So I'm curious what you make of the approach that Arizona Right to Life is taking to maybe like a parallel tracks here.
Well, they're right to do so. And here's the problem generally, though. This should have been debated at a committee hearing. We don't have – obviously, this never made it through the process. And because of the
legislative process, you mean.
Correct.
Yeah.
And because of the Voter Protection Act, what we have is what we have. I mean, if you'll notice in the language, there's no use of the term doctor or physician. There's no definition of who a medical provider is. All of these things would have gotten fleshed out in a legislative committee. And so I think that Arizona Right to Life is correct in bringing this up and raising these kinds of issues.
Tom, do you think that a judge is going to ultimately kick this off?
No. Let me go through a couple quick things here. First off, in response to something Paul said, Arizona Constitution adopted in 1910 during the Progressive Era said, we give certain enumerated powers to the state legislature. Any power not given to the state legislature is reserved to the people. That's in our Constitution. One of those rights is the right of initiative. And so when the people feel, and 800,000 plus people felt, that the state of Arizona legislature was not appropriately responding to this issue, they signed it and said, we want to take control of it then. That's what our Constitution allows. The signature verification issue is a very hard one to beat with that many signatures. It's not going to happen. The other issue is, as they're talking about, well, what's the term that should be in the publicity pamphlet and on the ballot language?
Yeah.
And the issue is whether or not they should say unborn human being or fetus. And what what they acknowledge, the Arizona Right to Life says, is both phrases carry an ideological valence. So the problem – valence, V-A-L-E-N-C-E. And so the question becomes, what is going to be the language? And I'll tell you what I think the outcome will ultimately be at the ballot box. If you are a pro-life, right-to-life person, anti-abortion person, you're going to vote against the proposition, whether it says fetus or unborn human being. And if you are a pro-choice, reproductive freedom person, you're going to vote for the proposition. So I don't think what language they ultimately use will differ.
It's an interesting point. Yeah. I mean, Paul, it's an interesting point about how much people read the publicity pamphlets that they get mailed to them, how much that really – especially on an issue like this where it seems like people's opinions are kind of baked in at this point. I mean, do you get the sense that how this is described in the pamphlet will ultimately impact – assuming it makes the ballot, assuming it stays on the ballot, does what's in the publicity pamphlet ultimately impact the result?
I think you look at the pro and the con statements and the Clean Elections puts out that the voter
people
education
can send
guide.
In and stuff. Yeah.
I think that matters. I also think that, again, just like Kamala Harris, I think that once voters start to realize what this actually does, where healthcare professional is not defined, who can do an abortion? Can a podiatrist give an abortion? That's a healthcare professional. Can a athletic trainer? I mean, I'm not being cheeky on that last. It's not defined, and this would have been addressed. Someone who assists with an abortion cannot be prosecuted, even if they're a perpetrator who has gotten a young girl pregnant and wants to have that baby aborted. They cannot be prosecuted under this under this language because, again, none of this was vetted.
But do you think voters really study the language that closely to get the details, or is it I favor abortion rights. I'm voting yes. I am pro-life. I'm voting no.
Yeah, I mean, I think with probably 80%, that's the case. But that's why I think it's incumbent upon those of us that do oppose this to educate the public that the 20% that will look at the language and say, yeah, I think it goes too far.
All right. So, guys, we have just a few minutes left. And Tuesday, of course, of next week is primary day. Although, as we know, in Arizona, it's primary month, right? I mean, ballots have been out for several weeks now. So, again, crystal balls being cloudy. We're not going to hold anybody to anything here. But I want to sort of get your takes on where we are right now. And Paul, I want to start with you in a congressional primary out in close to where you live in CD8. This is the race to replace Debbie Lesko, who is leaving Congress. There's a number of candidates in this race, including Abe Hamadeh and Blake Masters and Ben Thoma and Trent Franks and Anthony Kern. There might be one or two more out there. We've seen some polling on this, but I'm curious what your gut tells you about who's going to come out on top.
Yeah. So, well, first off, that race has gotten ugly. I live in that district.
Yeah.
And there are signs of Abe Hamadeh with him wearing a Muslim outfit saying a quote from him allegedly, I don't know if this is true or not, that America was founded on Islamic principles.
Yeah.
Those are street signs on every corner. And all the hit pieces going after Blake Masters, really they're going after each other. Anthony doesn't really have much money, so he's really not doing much. But my prediction, I think it's going to be Trent Franks.
Really?
I do.
You think he returns?
I do.
Wow.
I think, here's why. I think that Abe and Blake, who don't even live in the district, are attacking each other so much, and Anthony's going to peel off some of that support. And you know, back to casual voters who've always voted for Trent Franks in the past, I really think he could pull it out.
So where – I'm just curious where you see Ben Thoma, the current Speaker of the House, fitting in there, because the conventional wisdom had been, as you say, maybe Hamadeh and Masters sort of split the true MAGA vote, and then that maybe allows Ben Thoma to – slide in with, 20-22% and take the primary. It doesn't sound like that's what you think is going to happen.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll see. I mean, he's gotten a lot of money. He's gotten support from the Free Enterprise Club, with the national group. He's gotten a lot of support from outside groups. So he very well.
And support from Jan Brewer,
who
is from that area as well. All right. So, Tom, we have some Democratic primaries. I want to start in CD1, which is Scottsdale, Fountain Hills, that area. This also has, I think, maybe six Democrats in there.
One woman and five men.
Yeah. So who do you – and we've seen a little bit of polling on this as well. And the winner so far, at least in the poll I saw, was undecided.
Yeah. I think right now it's the horse race between Andre Cherney, who is a well-recognized Democratic operative, and –
former chair of the state Democratic Party as well.
Former state chair of the Democratic Party, and Marlene Galan Woods, the widow of well-known, well-respected former Attorney General Grant Woods. She has really run a great race. She's had great support from Chris Mays. A lot of people – she's got a lot of union support. That makes a big difference. I think she wins by a nose, but that's my guess.
So in CD8, that whoever wins the primary is most likely going to win the general election. That's a very solidly Republican district. CD1, Democrats see as a pickup opportunity against incumbent David Schweikert. Who do you think is the strongest candidate against Schweikert?
Again, I think it's probably in that, if you're asking who's the strongest candidate, Marlene Galan Woods. She's a great on the stump speech. She's great with the crowd. She's going to have a lot of support. David has a lot of baggage, but it doesn't seem to matter within the Republican Party that he has had so much baggage, and he's been returned to office in spite of all of his ethics problems.
All right. I want to ask you very quickly about the third congressional district. This is Ruben Gallego's district. He, of course, is leaving to run for Senate. We have Yasemin Ansari, Raquel Turan, and Dwayne Wooten are running in this Democratic primary. Who do you see coming out on top there?
I think it'll be Ansari.
Okay.
Turan's been working it hard, but I think Ansari's got the cash and the support.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. Tom Ryan, Paul Boyer, thanks you both for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, why young people are obsessing over slime green and calling Kamala Harris brat. But first, in April, Governor Katie Hobbs signed a bill designating Pluto as Arizona's state planet. Pluto was, of course, discovered at Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff. But in 2006, its planetary status was downgraded to dwarf planet, to the devastation of many. There is still debate over whether or not Pluto should be considered a planet, and a contingent of the scientific world is pro-Pluto. Eric Ault writes for National Geographic. For an article published in February, he talked with pro-Pluto astronomer Philip Metzger and on the anti-Pluto side, Mike Brown, astronomer and author of the book, How I Killed Pluto and Why It Had It Coming. Ault spoke with my co-host Lauren Gilger earlier this year about their debate.
It's something that has been sort of a kernel of debate for some time. A lot of it has to do with the IAU, the International Astronomical Union, sort of developing a criteria for what defines a planet. And that kind of came obviously much, much later than the discovery of Pluto, which was in the 1930s. And that kind of had people sort of retroactively look back and go, well, if this is the criteria for a planet, then Pluto doesn't actually fall into this category. It's not actually a planet. So it seems like it's something where it's been something of a debate within the community for really quite some time as they discovered new planets, new bodies. There was a planet called Eris that potentially could have been one, and then it ended up being not quite able to designate as a planet. So I think there were sort of new discoveries in the last 20, 30 years that sort of put into question, you know, what is a planet? And it kind of centered around Pluto because Pluto sort of became the most famous case.
Right. So there's this argument that they bring up that, like, because of, you know, dwarf planets, these other objects out there in the distant reaches of our solar system, like Pluto, like, if we were to consider Pluto a planet, we would also have to consider, like, hundreds of other objects out there, planets. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, there could be infinite number. I mean, there could be as many as 200 planets in our solar system, which is funny because I think a lot of people, because a lot of people grow up making the little sort of, you know, foam ball solar systems when they're in elementary school. And it's like, there's a nice symmetry to it. There's, you know, 8 or 9. It's kind of a nice round number, but it's like, yeah, it could be as many as 200. And I think there's, I don't know if there's a need to really limit it, but it just seems like there's a nice kind of like, it's easier to wrap your head around, you know, a set number of planets as opposed to like an infinite number.
Yeah. And as a parent of little kids, I can tell you, you know, infinite kids books about the planets, right?
You know, it's funny. I actually just the other day was in a CVS and they had, you know, a kid's, it was like, there were little chalk balls that were to represent all the planets. It was like a solar system chalk ball. And they had Pluto in there, and they had in parentheses dwarf planet. So it's like they still want to include it. They still love to have it in there, but they just quite can't let go of it.
That's so funny. It's true. We cannot let go of Pluto. Okay. So I want to hear about the other side of this debate, right? Like, you're talking to these two experts. I didn't even realize there's sort of an anti-Pluto contingent in the science world and then a pro-Pluto contingency. What are the pro-Pluto people saying here? What's their argument for the fact that it should still be a planet?
Well, one of the funniest things that, and this came from Mike Brown, who is on the anti-Pluto side of things, he also clarified that it's not a huge divide in the science community. There are very vocal factions, but it's not like there's a huge division. But there is a small faction that's very pro-Pluto, and he suspects that the reason is that most of those people were involved in the 2006 New Horizons program, where they sent a vessel up to Pluto, and they were all so deeply involved. And a lot of them, one of them were upset because by the time the vessel came back, Pluto was no longer a planet. So it was like, it was a planet when they left, but it wasn't a planet when they came back. And I think they kind of want to fight for sort of the relevance of that program. So I think that's part of it. I also think from talking to Philip Metzger, who's on the pro-Pluto side, he thinks that the criteria that the IAU came up with is just doesn't take into account a lot of other factors. And one of the most interesting things that he said was, in fact, they were really surprised at how diverse the planetary makeup of Pluto is. And as a matter of fact, it's one of the more Earth-like planets in terms of having its geography is so diverse and its atmosphere. And it actually has a lot of the elements that make it one of the most Earth-like planets. So I think there's a sense of like not holding it to such a strict criteria. I think it allows it to kind of make its case that it really should be among the main, I guess you could call the main planets. But one of the funniest things that Philip said in the interview was that even though their name is the International Astronomical Union, they are very adverse to astronomical numbers. They don't want endless numbers of planets. They want a very tight group of planets.
Okay, so there's also this idea of an actual, like, and yet undiscovered ninth planet out there, right? Mm-hmm. That's been discussed quite a bit in these circles. What's that about? And how does that kind of play into this debate?
Yeah, no, that's very true. Mike Brown has been very involved in what they're called Planet Nine or the ninth planet. They're constantly searching because one of the things that he said was that, you know, obviously technology has improved by leaps and bounds even within the last 20 years. I mean, we see it. He used the analogy of a digital camera. I mean, we were all excited by, like, you know, 400 pixels early on, but now you've got, you know, extreme high def and extreme quality. And that has really helped that community explore an infinite number of potential planets, or at mm-hmm. least planetoids or celestial objects. So they are finding evidence of this planet by tracing, you know, orbits of surrounding bodies and things like that. But they haven't actually quite found the planet yet. But there's enough evidence to suggest something is there. They just need to really hone in and pinpoint where it is.
Just gives you an idea of how big space is. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's funny to think that you could have all this evidence of something, but you still can't quite see it.
So I wonder then, after having talked to both of these people who are experts on both sides, what do you think? Like, are you on the pro-Pluto side, or do you think it's really not a planet?
I will say I did a complete 180. I came in, I was of the mind that, now, Pluto shouldn't be a planet. I kind of was like, oh, you know, I think it's true. I think, you know, when it was discovered, it was, you know, the technology was still so limited. And I think people were just excited by the idea of a new planet.
Yeah.
And kind of jumped on it. So I was ready to be very anti-Pluto. But I have to say, hearing Philip's arguments about that, you know, the atmosphere, the geography, how the criteria doesn't quite match up with some of the other accepted planets. He won me over. I think he won me over. I think I'm going to be pro-Pluto now.
All right. Pro-Pluto there. This is Eric Alt, National Geographic contributing writer, here to tell us more about this apparently ongoing debate. Eric, thank you so much for coming on and explaining this. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Opening ceremonies for the 2024 Olympics will take place today. And for a couple of weeks, the world will watch fantastic athletes compete hard for gold medals. For Chris Vera Phillips, it's a time to pause and consider her young son's experience in the swimming pool.
All right, this will be heat number two. Take your mark.
Just keep kicking. That was my mantra for my 7-year-old kid at his first swim meet at Chandler High. It was also my rallying cry as he moved closer to the finish line, a.k.a. the other side of the pool. 25 yards and 46.39 seconds later, he climbed out of his lane, and a coach awarded my kid his first ribbon ever. He stood up a little straighter, and his face beamed. Contestants and their families from swim schools across the valley showed up for the swim meet. In the beginning, we needed to learn the language of a swim meet, like the difference between an event and a heat. The event described the type of race, 25-yard freestyle or backstroke, breaststroke or butterfly. And that's for my kids' age group. Also, the heat is the group of swimmers who line up and race at the same time. It's overwhelming for anyone who is new to the sport. And before his heat, my kid crossed his arms behind his back trying to figure it all out. Patient and kind coaches helped him. He lined up behind his lane, crouching by the water, waiting for his race. I know what it's like to wait like that. I started competitive figure skating when I was 5 years old. On the ice, when I waited for my music to start, it was the first time in my life I felt alone. Then the music started. My heart bloomed as I moved. I felt the adrenaline rush and confidence from sliding, spinning, and jumping. Not many people could do what I could do, not my family in the stands or my friends at school. Thanks to high-profile athletes, we also know there's a dark side to competition. A few years ago, Olympic swimmer Michael Phelps opened up about his mental health struggles. Before he got help, he looked at himself as an athlete and not as a human being, he said. Katie Ledecky will represent Team USA in Paris for the Summer Games. She says she takes swimming seriously, but she also remembers that she started swimming for the fun of it when she was 6 years old. My family will watch her on TV along with other American Olympians, having fun racing and maybe breaking a couple of world records. Some parents may see swimming, or any sport, as a path to college scholarships, Nike endorsements, and other opportunities that could give their family a break from the sacrifices they've made. Those expectations could crush anybody, especially young athletes. Those expectations can turn a love of sport into an unhealthy obsession that forces a kid to choose between competition and their mental health. So when we watch Ledecky competing in the 400-meter freestyle, I want to point out to my kid what hard work and practice can do and what it looks like to do your best. I want him to see the joy in swimmers' faces after they finish a race. I also want him to understand that not everyone can finish first, and that's okay. Keep trying. Don't give up. Do your best. These are lessons in endurance and resilience that my kid can use for the rest of his life. His coaches have one simple goal for him: get in the pool and swim your best. They hope kids will learn what they love about racing. After his heat, my kid showed off his ribbon to one of the coaches, and she gave him an otter pop to celebrate. His mouth turned bright blue as he waited for the next event. Competition tasted sweet.
Chris Vera Phillips is a PhD candidate at ASU's Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication. As you may have heard, President Joe Biden announced his withdrawal from the presidential race in a letter to the American people last Sunday, endorsing Vice President Kamala Harris as his successor. But Biden wasn't the only public figure whose writing would upend the campaign that day. Later the same evening, pop music megastar Charlie XCX, whose most recent album is called Brat, tweeted three words that also captivated American political discourse: Kamala is Brat. Many cultural commentators had previously observed that Brat Summer was already in full swing thanks to the album's massive success, but the tweet seemed to anoint Vice President Harris as a Gen Z icon, prompting a burst of enthusiasm for her candidacy, particularly among young voters. Much of this took the form of memes and TikTok videos showing Harris against a backdrop that referenced the album's cover art, which is just the word Brat in lowercase black letters set against a bright green square. To make sense of this complex pop culture moment, we turned, as we often do, to Amanda Kerberg, a PhD candidate at ASU who studies digital culture. She spoke with the show's Sam Dingman.
I would say Brat Summer is sort of it's like a Venn diagram center between realness and authenticity and messiness and being open and honest. That is so a part still of how to communicate in digital culture, and especially how to communicate with Gen Z. But I think we're all still a little afraid of that. Like, there's a—
For sure.
Right? Dishonesty can also be messy and playful. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And we have to be wary.
So I guess this sort of leads to the— I was going to say the red letter story, but I guess it's a black letter story with a green background.
I was going to say, yeah, the green background. I meant to look up the HTML and the Pantone color for that. They workshopped 65 greens. And also what's so funny about that is all of the trend reports have been saying 2024 was blue. And
Whoa.
Then out of nowhere.
And Charlie was like, nope.
Out of nowhere. Slime green it is.
Wow. So this Kamala is Brat thing.
Yes.
It felt like the kind of moment that every politician dreams of, the most zeitgeisty pop star declaring them to be completely aligned with the zeitgeist.
Yeah.
So why did it work so well?
A lot of the conversation around Kamala Harris's past primary campaign and its failure kind of hinges on not being authentic enough, like worrying too much about curating your image for public consumption, what they wanted. And so we got this weird pivotal moment of this transition between Joe Biden, whose persona is kind of inextricably linked to a little bit of messiness and some gaffes and some, you know,
some plagiarism.
Just, you know. So we're coming out of weeks of the news cycle just kind of focusing in on those gaffes and turning them into a much more negative story than the kind of lovable, says some, you know, wrong, dumb things sometimes, you know?
Right.
So this was such an interesting paradigm shift in how we see saying dumb things and still finding those people lovable and relatable. It functioned to work as a transition between Biden, but also to transition him out of that media narrative so effortlessly into Kamala Harris, allowing her to take on the positive side of that kind of relatable, kind of messy, why people love Joe. And I still don't even know how it worked so well. There's some element about it that is a pushback against mainstream media and how they'd been framing the narrative for the prior, say, 3-4 weeks.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because I think there was a kind of unsettling about the way Biden was being covered, the way Trump was being covered, and a little bit of a fear about, you know, hey, we lived through 2016. We've seen.
a fear on the part of Gen Z?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Of just, let's just completely reframe this using our methods, our apps,
right,
and our edits. And I don't know that I've ever seen a media narrative turned upside down so incredibly quickly.
Oh, it's remarkable. And to the point you were making about how, you know, if we go just on the kind of high-level characteristics of what we associate with Brad, like messiness, sloppiness, the authenticity of that messiness and sloppiness.
Yeah.
Those are all the things that people who love Donald Trump praise about him.
Yeah.
But like Joe Biden, nobody's saying Donald Trump is Brad, at least that I'm aware of.
Yeah. Yeah. I think part of that is he is extremely messy, but there is not always a consistent authenticity there. There is just a,
and that's interesting.
I would say there's not like a core narrative there.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, I know we're sort of arbitrarily choosing adjectives here, but like for the purpose of a public radio explainer, it almost feels like we could say, you know, if it's messy, authentic, playful.
Yes.
Then maybe it's that Biden has messy and authentic, but not playful.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
Trump has messy and playful, but not authentic.
Yeah.
And Kamala, it seems to Gen Z, has all three.
Yes, which is, again, really interesting. And I think there is a little bit of Gen Z and just the digital audience being brats to the mainstream media in how this all came about.
In the spirit of the patron saint of brat, Charlie XCX, I wrote down some lyrics from some of her songs.
Okay.
And I want to put these lyrics to you, and I'm going to ask you to name something in the news of the last week, can be political or not political, that this lyric makes you think of.
Okay.
All right. The first one is from Talk Talk. We've been talking for months, but never in the same room.
That would be, you know what? I'm going to go with Pelosi and Biden.
Perfect answer.
It felt like months.
Perfect answer. So a reference there, of course, to Nancy Pelosi using all of her power to convince Biden to drop out through appeals from outside the room he was in.
Yes.
Okay, amazing answer. Next from Rewind. Sometimes I really think it would be cool to rewind.
It's really ridiculous. I was like, I just want to say me because I miss Blockbuster all the time.
Blockbuster
and,
Video.
Yeah. And I saw, I've seen like three people with Blockbuster t-shirts in the last month.
Mm.
And you know what? That was the happiest time of my life. Friday night, going to Blockbuster Video.
Thank you for sharing that, Amanda. And just to join you in that, as a fellow, I don't want to assume, but indoor kid. My relationship with the summer was not like, let's go out in the fields and you can tell I didn't spend much time outside because I don't know how to end that sentence. But
what do people do in fields?
Yeah. I don't know. Because I associated summer with, I'm going to go to Blockbuster.
Yes.
I'm going to get a stack of DVDs.
Yes.
And I'm going to watch all of them.
Yeah. Y'all don't understand. You're paralyzed by opportunity. Streaming has given you a cornucopia of options.
Yeah. And this nostalgia for bygone times is how you can tell neither of us is Gen Z.
No, we are not.
Okay. This last one from Apple. Very dramatic. I think the apple's rotten right to the core.
I will say I think that that was the sentiment from just a week ago in the political discourse. I think a lot of people felt not listened to, especially in Gen Z, and the feeling of just malaise and inevitability and not in a good way. And and I think the Google Trends of searches for moving abroad will attest to that.
Okay, well, let's talk about
Portugal. That's my plan.
All right. Well, if you need her, she will be in Coimbra. Our digital culture and pop culture expert, PhD student at the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication, Amanda Kerberg. Thank you so much,
Thank you so much. It's always a great time.
And that'll do it for this Friday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for listening. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, Ayanna Hamilton, Gabriella Fernbaugh, and reporter Sam Dingman, as well as Bruce Drummond. Sky Shout is our digital editor, Chad Snow, our news director. The show is created by John Hoban. Our executive producer is Amy Silverman. For Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Rohde. Have a terrific rest of your day. Have a great weekend. Hope to have you right back here on Monday.